All right. Parshat Vayigash. Okay, the time period of Parshat Vayigash is 5 years. The last 5 years of the famine. We spoke last time. Binyamin is caught red-handed with the goblet in his sack. And they offer, please take all of us. And Yosef says, no, I'm only going to take whoever stole the goblet. And Yehuda now approaches Yosef. That's what Vayigash is. Yehuda approaches Yosef about Binyamin. And he gives a very passionate speech. He talks about his elderly father who is going to die if his beloved son is not returned. According to the Ramban, there's also strong hints that Yosef is to blame for all of this. He, Yehuda, guaranteed the return of Binyamin to his father. That's why he is speaking up. And he says, I will stay. I'll be an Eved. Just let Binyamin go. I will take his place. And after this impassioned speech, Yosef can't hold back. He kicks out all non-family members, and he reveals his identity. He cries out, Ani Yosef ha'od avi chai. I am Yosef. Is my father still alive? Now say, I am Yosef. I get it. He's revealing his identity. Why does he have to say ha'od avi chai? I mean, that was the whole speech. The whole speech was, Dad is suffering. There's no way I'll be able to go back and tell him Binyamin's not here. What does it mean when he says Ha'od Avi Chai? So Rabbanik says a beautiful idea. He says, I have no idea if your speech was all a ruse just to gain his freedom. Maybe he made this up. Maybe your dear old dad, our dear old dad, died years ago, but in order to try to elicit emotion on the part of the viceroy, you made up this whole sob story about a father who's mourning his son and he won't be able to live without Binyamin. So now I'm fessing up. I'm Yosef. All right, tell me the truth. Is Dad still alive? Interesting way of looking at it. The brothers are stunned into silence. Yosef consoles them and said it was God's plan that he is sent there to sustain the family throughout the period of the famine. He then adjures them to quickly go back and tell Abba about Yosef, to bring him here so Yosef could sustain the family. He then hugs Binyamin, and they cry. He cries with all the brothers. He kisses them. And according to the Radak, they sit around and catch up on the last 22 years. Okay. It would seem, I think we mentioned this last time, the plan of Yosef was to take Binyamin and start the Jewish nation through Bnei Rachel. Right? The way that the Jewish nation went through Sarah and not through Hagar. So maybe we're now also going to just continue through Bnei Rachel. While he felt, as we said before, that his family abandoned him, he never felt God did. But all that changed now. Because of Yehuda. Yehuda changed Jewish history. We could have had a split. He would have changed Jewish history with his speech. The question is, how did Yehuda change Yosef's mind? If Yosef was planning on taking Binyamin, he still had all the leverage. He could have taken Binyamin. He could have kicked him out. He could have said, no, I'm taking the thief. Go away. Like, what happened? What did Yehuda do? Let me tell you two very interesting ways of looking at it. According to the Meshech Chachma, Yehuda realized something was wrong with the accusation. Because if Binyamin was really a thief, there's no way Yosef takes him as a slave in his household because he's not trustworthy. Like, why would you take a thief to work for you as a slave? So there's already something that's bothering him by his insistence on, no, I'm taking him as a slave and not anyone else. Then Itziv goes further with the suspicion and says, originally Yehuda assumed that they were being punished for the crime that they did, as we spoke about last time, what they did to Yosef 22 years earlier. Okay, and that's why they were put in jail in the first place, and now this is why all of this trouble is happening. But when he realizes that, wait, one second, who's now being taken? The only brother who was not involved in the sin towards their brother Yosef. then this can't be a punishment from God. Had we, the 10 of us, been punished, okay, hashgacha pratit, we're getting punished for what we did, as they spoke about in the previous parasha. But when the only kid not involved with whatever befell Yosef in his fate is the one that's being taken, and the others are now being sent home, he realized it's not God, it's the viceroy. So now he begins to think, why would he want to take Binyamin? Why Binyamin? Unless, and now all these thoughts go through his head, unless, maybe, he's thinking about it. What goes on here? Shimon was taken hostage when the other ones were sent back home. Shimon happened to be the instigator when Yosef appeared at the pit, at least according to Chazal. Then, as we mentioned last week, Yosef, according to the Midrash, banged his little goblet and then said, okay, I'm going to sit you in age order. You, Reuven, right here. Shimon, right there. Look. Also quite odd. And why does Yehuda start talking to him about their dad that's back in Eretz Yisrael? What, do you think the viceroy could care less? Can you imagine the Jews started arguing with the Nazi and said, I was going to kill my dad. Okay, he was next on my list anyway. Like, why does Yehuda think that by talking about how their dad is going to suffer, if they don't bring Binyamin back, that's going to change the mind of the viceroy who thinks that his magical goblet was stolen by Binyamin? Unless. And here's where he starts to put things together. Rav Soloveitchik said, once had this chus of hearing Rav Soloveitchik speak on Parashat HaShavua. It was this parasha. Okay, my first year in YU, he gave a parsha shir. It was then discontinued because of his health. But I remember distinctly this parsha shir. He said that the battle between Yehuda and Yosef in the beginning of Parsha Vayigash has eschatological significance. What does that mean? The winner of this battle gets Mashiach. The winner of the battle gets Mashiach. And then the Rav went on to say, Yehuda had to win. The Mashiach needs to understand the mind of the sinner. And he goes on to say how Yehuda sinned with Tamar, and later David with Bathsheba. When Mashiach comes along, he's going to be able to look at us and say, all right, been there, done that, let me help you, you know, do tshuva, as opposed to Yosef, who would just say, how could you sin? Just say no, I did. Right? And therefore, Yehuda had to win. I always love this Dvar Torah. I remember arguing with my Rebbe in high school when he said that Yehuda didn't sin, even though it says Tamar was a prostitute, it was different. And I said, why, what's wrong with saying that he sinned in the tshuva? No. So I was very happy when Rav Soloveitchik said he sinned. And he, okay, anyway, it was good for me. That's why I remember this whole thing. But the difference between a Baal Tshuva and a Tzaddik is significant. The Baal Tshuva says, okay, I understand. And he now is a different person. It's true, Yosef gets Mashiach ben Yosef coming from him, but it's still not Mashiach ben David. So he's still stuck with, how did Yehuda win? Yes, he won. And luckily for us, Mashiach ben David is going to understand all of our failures and is going to help us do tshuva. But the question is still out there. How did Yehuda convince Yosef to reveal his identity? Because again, according to the plan, he's just taken Binyamin, they're starting all over again. What pressure point? What did he do that made Yosef reveal his identity against his plan? Rav Amnon Bazak says it's a beautiful idea. It says like this. The long speech that we have, beginning of Parshat Vayigash, that starts from Pasuk Yud Chet and goes all the way to Pasuk Lamed Dalet, 18 to 34. It's all unnecessary. Could have just had the last two psukim. The last two psukim say, take me, I can't do this to my father. What was the need for 16 psukim? That's all he was really saying. So you look at the speech. He mentions Abba, Dad, 14 times. He mentions Avi, my father, 7 times. But the turning point is Psukim 27 to 29. Chaf Zayin to Chaf Tet. Listen to these Psukim. Tayomer Avdecha Avi Aleinu, our father. I'm sorry. He said, your servant, my father, said to us, Yedatem, you know, Kishnayim Yaldali Ishti. My wife had 2 kids. Think about that sentence. Yehuda is saying that my father said to me, Yehuda, that you know my wife had 2 kids. Was he referring to? Rachel. Who are his only 2 kids? Yosef and Binyamin. Is Yehuda telling the story? Abba said, my wife had 2 kids. And he goes on to say, and one is now missing. He must have been ripped apart by wild animals. I have not seen him. If you take him from me, and a tragedy happens, I will go down to my grave in grief. Does anyone really think that Yaakov would be so insensitive that he would say to one of his sons, you know, my wife had only 2 kids? I mean, Dad, what about me? So it's clear that he never would have said such a thing. But what's also clear is that every single brother knew that that was the truth. Yaakov didn't have to say it. It was so clear that that's how he felt. It says in the Torah 6 times that Yaakov loved someone more than anyone else in Tanakh. 3 times it says he loved Rachel. 2 times it said he loved Yosef. And here, 1 time, it says he loved Binyamin. It was clear to all the brothers who was Yaakov's wife and who were Yaakov's sons. He didn't have to say it. It was obvious. In 46:19, what does it say? B'nei Rachel, Eshet Yaakov, Yosef u'Binyamin. Earlier, just said, Ela b'nei Leah. These are Leah's kids, but these are Rachel, Yaakov's wife's kids. Yosef u'Binyamin. And the climax, this is crazy. 49:31. One second. Listen to this pasuk. Here we go. Yaakov is saying to Yosef why he needs to be buried in the Marat HaMachpelah. He says, "B'marash yebestei Machpelah shel pnei mamre be'eretz Kanan asher kana Avraham et hasadeh me'eit efron achiti lachuzat kaver." This week's parasha, right? Parasha Chayisara says, "This is the land that was bought by Avram from Ephron Achiti, the Marat HaMachpelah." Now listen to the words. Shama kavru et Avram vet Sarah ishto. There is buried Avram and Sarah his wife. Shama kavru et Yitzchak vet Rivka ishto. And there is buried Yitzchak and Rivka his wife. The Shama kavarti et Leah and the pasuk. So say, ishti. The Shama kavarti et Leah. And there I buried Leah, my wife. And there I buried Leah. Avram buries Sarah, his wife. Yitzchak buries Rivka, his wife. And I buried Leah. It is clear to all the brothers that Yaakov has one wife and has 2 sons. And he didn't have to say that pasuk. They all felt it.
Do the wives die first?
It would seem so in all cases. Also, look at who his son is. In when Yosef goes missing, 37:32. Okay, they send the bloody ktonet pasim back. Zot matzano akerna hakatonet bimchachi imlo. Is this your sons? Vayikira. Vayomer ktonet bini. Chayara achoto. Yes, it's my sons. Terov, terov Yosef. Vayikra Yaakov simlato. Vayasem sakum atno. Vayitabel al bino. Yamrim rabim. And he mourns for his son. Vayikumu kol banav achol benatav lachamo. All his children get up to console him. Vayomer ki arayed el bini. Avel shal vayavech oto aviv. Says, I'm going to go down to my death mourning for my son. So now imagine, you're Yosef, and you're hearing this. And what are you hearing? Yaakov Avinu had really only one wife. He had really only two sons. And everyone knows that. And who's arguing to save Binyamin? The neglected son. Yehuda, who does not feel loved, knows that he's not his father's favorite, certainly not even in the top two, because not from the right mother. And yet, what is Yehuda saying? He has so much love for his father that he's saying, take me instead. I can't do this to my Abba. To the point that Yosef has to cry out, he's my Abba too. And that's what did it. When Yosef hears how much love and concern that Yehuda has for a father that doesn't love him, and he's being told over and over, the only people that he really loves are Rachel, Yosef, and Binyamin. There's no longer, he can't go on with the shrei. And he just blurts it out. He goes, Ani Yosef. He's my Abba too. I don't know. I thought, when I read that, I was like, wow. What a beautiful explanation of how he got Yosef to change his mind. Or, maybe, this is my own suggestion, I like Rabbi Zaks better. But I'm going to tell you this other idea based on stuff we said before. Maybe we can see the entire story differently. When the brothers come, Yosef remembers them. He remembers his dreams, as Ramban said. But he realizes, as I think as we pointed out the last time, that he misinterpreted them. He's not going to rule over them. Rather, he's going to provide for them. But he realizes that if he reveals his identity too quickly, they'd be startled. And instead he decides he's going to leave little breadcrumbs. Try to leave hints along the way for them to pick up on who it is. He's playing hide and seek, but he wants them to find him. Right? So he says, as we said before, oh, I'll seat you in age order. I mean, that should arouse some suspicion. He says, I believe in God, I'm a Yirei Shamayim, so my word is my bond. I'll give you everything back. I'm holding Shem, bring Binyamin, it's all good. He, when they come back with the money, as we said last time, his assistant, who according to Chazal, is his son Menashe, says, well, your God must like you, so hold on to the money. All of these hints, he's like wondering. He's trying to say, don't you see me? It's me. I'm Yosef. I remember when my grandsons were little, they were playing like hide and seek in the house. And my son like said, okay, I'm coming to find you. And then my like 2-year-old grandson said, I'm right here behind the curtains. Okay, like, you know, okay. So he didn't really understand how the game was. But that's what Yosef's doing. Yosef is dropping all these hints, waiting for the brothers to pick up on them. He says, he figures that the brothers, yeah, must be that the Midianites that pulled him out of the pit, how did they know where to find him? Well, the brothers sold him into slavery and told the Midianites, okay, took the money, go down about 100 paces, see that tree, go to the right, and there's a pit. And now, yes, a little startling to find the slave as the viceroy, but as he gives hints after hints after hints, he assumes that by now they figure it out. The only thing is, what Yosef doesn't realize is the brothers are holding like the Rashbam's explanation, which we said before, that the brothers think he really died. The brothers went to the pit, and he wasn't there, and they actually think he died. The Midianites took him out, the brothers got, they wanted to sell him, but he was gone. So it doesn't matter how many hints you're going to give. It doesn't matter how many coincidences there could be. If your brother's dead, you're not going to say, well, must be Yosef. Well, it's impossible. So the thought doesn't cross their minds. And that's what happened here. And like Yosef, how could they not get it? How stupid could they be? I'm sort of like pretty much just saying it. And then finally, when they can't get it, he says, all right, Ani Yosef. But that was why they didn't get it. He really, you know, is why he didn't matter how many coincidences till Yehuda put it together. And that's why it's not by chance that we end Miketz with suspense. Yehuda at the end of Miketz figures it out, and that's why he starts playing the Abba card. Abba, Avi, Abba, Avi. Finally, he says, all right, it's me. But no, it seems like he didn't even tell anyone. Like, he's like, I think he put it together. He finally realized, okay, we must have gotten it wrong. Must be like Rashi. You know, Rashbam is wrong. Must be like Rashi. Must be that, you know, actually, okay, sold as a slave. And he would have figured it out. He went from slave to viceroy. Okay. Anyway, I like Rob Bazak's better, but I still think this works. Okay. When Paro finds out that Yosef and these brothers, they're related, so he's very excited. He sends carriages to bring the family back. In his mind, this is assurance now, if Yosef's family comes, that Yosef will do every single thing that he could to keep the economy of Egypt running well. He'll do what's best for Egypt because his family's right there. Now, Soloveitchik added, maybe he also thinks the way Yosef is super talented, bringing some brothers will also in some way help, you know, the Egyptian culture, because look at what this family is. Probably his brothers will also do wonders for Egyptian culture. And therefore, everyone should come and makes contributions to the family. Yosef gives them provisions with clothing. He gives Binyamin more because he's his full brother. And provisions for their father, warning them not to fight on the way back. They tell Yaakov, Ha'od Yosef Chai V'hu Moshel B'Mitzrayim. Yaakov is stunned, nearly has a heart attack. Calms down, he begins to believe them when he sees the carriages, and he hears the message of Yosef. Yaakov stops in Beersheba on the way down to Egypt. He brings a korban and is assured by God not to fear going down to Egypt. According to the Ramban, he was telling him, this is the beginning of the Gullus, it's starting now. According to the Sforno, no. Yaakov originally planned on just visiting Yosef in Mitzrayim, maybe waiting out the famine, but obviously returning to Israel. But God assures him he will be with them and they should go down to Egypt. Yaakov's family comes down to Egypt. 70 in all. Problem is when you count it, you don't get to 70. Okay, you get to 69, counting the three in Egypt, Yosef, Menashe, and Ephraim. So what do you do with the 69? Rashi tells us what? Who's the 70th? Yocheved, who's born as they enter. She would be the, you know, there's only two other women that are mentioned in the list. She would be the third. The two women mentioned in the list are Dina and Serach, Serach bat Asher. That's why there's always Midrash about Serach bat Asher. We can't figure out why she made the list. Clearly Yaakov's family did not have, you know, 68 out of 70 males, right? We're everyone's wives. So it must be that we're only mentioning important people. Men are important in Chumash, unless a woman is serving a purpose. Dina, we already know. She already was in the story. And Sarah must serve some purpose. We don't know what it is. So therefore, there's a million Midrashim about the significance of Sarah. According to Rashi, there's a third, and that's Yocheved. Going to be Ibn Ezra, much simpler. Yaakov's the 70th. Altogether, it's Yaakov. We mentioned the, all right, so with Yaakov, we hit 70. That's Ibn Ezra. Yosef meets his father after 22 years. They embrace, they cry. Yaakov says, now that I saw you, my life is fulfilled. I can die. Yosef tells Paro that his brothers are shepherds, and therefore they should live apart in Goshen. He brings five to meet them. They request to live in Goshen, and Paro accepts because Egyptians hated shepherds. They worshipped the animals. They didn't want them to be livestock. And Paro agrees to let them live apart. Yosef brings Yaakov to meet Paro, and he asks how old he is, and he responds, 130 miserable years. Yosef gives his family the best part of Goshen, which is called Ramses. Now, the famine intensifies, and Yosef collects money for food. When the Egyptians can no longer pay money, so they start paying in cattle. When they run out of cattle, they then pay in land. And in the end, the people offered to become slaves because they had nothing more to offer and they wanted food. But Yosef, while having all the land, the government owns all the land, he, instead of keeping them as slaves, turns them into sharecroppers. Arisim, that we have in the Gemara. They become sharecroppers. And he makes a deal that they find to be very generous. He says to the sharecroppers, again, they have no leverage whatsoever, you work the land and you can keep 80% of your crop, and the government will just take 20%. And they readily agree to this deal. Yosef felt it's better to let the people be responsible for their own welfare than to live on handouts. And he sets up this society. I mentioned earlier this week, I don't remember which year, Vilna Gaon says the reason why we need all of this was to teach us that Mashiach ben Yosef will as well worry about the economics and provide stability for the nation before Mashiach ben David comes and does a spiritual revolution. Meanwhile, the Jews lived, bought land, and settled in Goshen, and multiplied. And the question is, why did they stay there? My daughter once asked me, she goes, I don't get it. You had to live in Egypt until the famine was over. Once the famine was over, they should have left. So the famine was 5 years. Yaakov himself lived another 12 years there. Why didn't they go back to Eretz Yisrael? So, like, I said, like my daughter even said, like, why didn't Yosef go back? I said, I don't know. Yosef lives like the life of the Jew in Chutz Laaretz, that he wants to live in Chutz Laaretz, just be buried in Israel. I don't know. I said that tongue in cheek, but then I heard Phil Nagon says a similar idea. Okay? I'm not going to mention Matan because you say, I always mention Matan. I say, Zionistic idea, so I won't mention Matan. But the Vilna Gaon says that when will Mashiach ben David come? Mashiach ben Yosef dies. The ideology of this Yosef, that I can live in Chutzpah, be buried in Israel, that has to die. We have to come to Eretz Israel and live here. Okay? I got Musar. When I was in BMT, I did Chesed. Like, you guys have Chesed on Tuesdays. We had Chesed. Oh, yeah, Thursdays, and then we had Chesed on Tuesday afternoons. And BMT didn't know, but I did this after-school program for kids, but I was doing it with some high school girl from Choriv. Okay? I don't think they would have approved. But anyway, we became friendly, traveling the bus back and forth. And like by the end of the year, she says to me, Sanu, when are you moving to Israel? And I said to her, you know, I'm really starting to love Israel. I think when I retire. Well, the truth is, I wasn't even thinking about moving when I retired. But I wanted to get it off my back. I said, yeah, I retire. And she looked at me and said, Israel doesn't need you to come here and die. Israel needs you to come here and do something. And that's the first time that I started thinking. Anyway, moving on. This is the question. So what's the answer? Why did they stay there? And here's this very interesting thing that happened. In contrast to the Egyptians who lose their fields, lose their homes, become subservient to Paro, the Jews have the status of aristocrats. They are landowners. They came in as poor Jews, but they became rich Jews. While the rich Egyptians became poor Egyptians. And now we know why the Jews stayed. They viewed themselves as upper class Egyptians. Their social status changed, and they couldn't go back to what they had before. And this is the story of Jews in Galus. We become successful after one or two generations, and then because of that success, become despised by the locals. The locals now look at us and are jealous of our success. The Yakum, what?
So it's still up to
this is exactly. The Yakum Melech Chadash, who Shelo Yadat Yosef. The Klei Yakar says all of this. And he says, and this is the problem. It says that they settled when they should have just dwelled there temporarily. But they allowed themselves to be grabbed. The Ya'achzuba, that's what it says. They were grabbed by the land and Egyptian culture. And in Vayikra, Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Bet, this is exactly how it explains the Pasuk. Pasuk says, Ki ma'aseh eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshachtim ba lo ta'asu. Usually that's translated as, don't do the despicable things that the Egyptians did when you were living there. We think it means that all their immorality and idolatry. Says the Kli Yakar, no. The key word is yeshachtim. Ki ma'aseh eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshachtim ba. Don't act the way you did when you decided to make Egypt into a permanent dwelling place. Don't make the same mistake. And with that, I end. Don't make the same mistake. Okay.